often taken aback when they ask me to take a photo or video of something they're doing. And I can't help but feel the deepest sense of irony when I actually hear myself say, "You know you don't need to take a photo of everything you do." These are more or less the same words they have said to me dozens of times in the past, when they were younger, when I wouldn't listen. Now that they are dipping their toes into social media and looking for their own content to share, it's jarring how often I'm even tangentially included in a photo or a video that I didn't know they were taking, and I screech, "Delete that now! Don't you dare post that!" I can't help but feel sheepish, knowing the tables are very much turned, that they deserved that same autonomy and power over their image and their lives. When you get right down to it, I felt that their likenesses, their words, their quips, and sadness all belonged to me. Maybe I felt that way because at one point they were me. And then once they were born, I poured everything I had into them. The hours of mothering are long and tedious. So when those moments of joy, beauty, laughter, and utter nonsense would bubble up, I wanted to hold them up. I thought those moments were all mine to share. Randomly throughout the years, they have been approached at barbecues and on beaches, at houses of friends, even hours away from where we live, by people they've never met. And those strangers have repeated back to them moments in their lives. Riding a horse for the first time, going on vacation, finishing school. How fucked up is that? Moments in their lives when just the two or three or four of us were present were opened up to 500 other people, without their consent. And yet here's the thing. When I page back through these tens of thousands of photos and hundreds of videos, I see not just their lives, but our lives, together. The stuffies and favorite shoes I had forgotten about, and just how little they used to be. There are the snowflakes on eyelashes in December, and the mud pie making in August. These are the small moments, the unposed moments, the long drives and the missing teeth. These are moments that would have been lost to me, guaranteed. I like having evidence of these moments. One time I was paging through the previous year's worth of photos as I hastily assembled a calendar for a Christmas gift. As I edited my way through the months, past the sledding in February and Easter egg hunts in April, Maine in the summertime and apple pies in September, I whispered to myself, "We have a good life. We have had a good life." My childhood was anonymous. Almost all of ours were. And I have raised my kids publicly. Not transparently, but publicly. I'm not sure what I will tell them if they ask me why I did that. Why all of us did that. What was the point? It's difficult to navigate something you have only experienced as an adult. Something you did not grow up with and therefore don't have the same developmental experience of. I suppose I will be honest with them. I will tell them that documenting them in all these ways made me proud, made me laugh, allowed me to connect with other parents and family and friends who were far away. It also drove me to make terrible and selfish decisions, because I lost sight of who they were and the rights they had. Because I was so deep in a second adolescence, where I was desperately seeking validation and approval. Where I did what everyone else did, more than everyone else did. So that it would all reflect back on me without consideration for how they might feel. I will tell them there is no easy answer. That on one hand I'm sorry, I made some appalling mistakes, I will do better. And that on the other, I'm happy I have all those pictures of them. I can't regret that. I will tell them that sharing is what we all learned to do in kindergarten. But this newish form of sharing is the furthest thing from that spirit. When we are young, we are taught to share to form community, to even out resources, and to feel good through giving. Now we are enticed to share to build ourselves up at the expense of others, like by like, into a castle with no foundation. A castle built on clouds. Thank you for including me on this meal train, but unfortunately, I'm a horrible person. Hello, practically a stranger. Although I've only seen your name under the People You May Know tab on Facebook, it seems you've roped me into a social obligation from which there is no graceful escape. I'm sure you assumed, since I'm a good friend of our mutual friend, that I share her more wonderful qualities like kindness, culinary skills, and the ability to find joy in feeding others. Well, would you believe I don't possess any of those? You would if you actually knew me. I want this to be a learning experience for both of us, but mainly for you. So I'm responding with a multiple-choice quiz that you may take at your leisure. Should I invite some of your tangential acquaintances to take it too? Maybe while they're at it, they could make you a meal and feel resentful about it? Anyway, I hope you'll find this quiz useful, at least more useful than I plan on being in this lifetime. Can you correctly guess my reactions to being added to this fucking meal train? A quiz. 1. I couldn't help but notice you've included me on this meal train for a mutual friend of ours who just, A, had a baby, B, suffered a death in the family, C, wait, what happened? Seems if I don't even know what happened, I'm probably not close enough friends with this person and therefore should definitely, definitely not be on this meal train. How did you find me? D. Bought a house. Did it not come with a kitchen? Seems like a buyer beware situation to me. E. I literally don't care. 2. Of course, my first reaction was A. Ugh! No! No! B. Bitch, I can't even properly prepare meals for my own family as it is. C. Maybe I never saw this. D. I'm gonna act like I never saw this. E. I did not see this. 3. Then reality struck and I, A. forced myself to add some cheerful comment as confirmation I have received this fucking thing. Ugh, fuck this fucking thing. B. Momentarily deluded myself for 5 whole minutes by believing I can actually do this. Look at me, everyone, I'm turning over a new leaf. One where I make a complete and delicious meal as a gesture of support and non-assholeness on behalf of my friend in need. I am a good person. C. I am not a good person. D. Accepted that even my kids know I don't say, I love you and I'm here for you with food. It's more like, maybe you could stay alive for another day. E. Clapped twice and summoned the pizza menus. 4. And finally, I, A, will wait as long as possible to commit to a date, hoping whatever the issue is has resolved itself by then. B, will text with other horrible people about our shared meal train rage. Trust me, it's a thing. C, will sheepishly search for articles about meal train etiquette, because if I'm going to do this, I'm not going to lose face over it. Fuck that shit. D, will flip out when I realize the meal needs to be dairy-free. What in the ever-loving Christ? E. Will order pizza anyway in a shot heard round the world act of sabotage that broadcasts, I'm obviously not very good at this and I might possibly even accidentally kill people, so maybe no one should include me on one of these things ever, ever again. 5. And then I spent a few days attempting to think deeply on this act of forcible community support and why it made me so nuts. Turns out, I could think shallowly about it and end up at the same place, which was, A. I see a lot of women's names on these things. And by a lot of women's names, I mean only women's names. Meal trains, bake sales, potlucks, all those kitcheny, bakey, cookie things. Is this what the 1950s were like? Because if so, I'm here to tell you the 1950s sucked. B. Do men not know how to plan and cook a meal? The fact that out of over 100 Michelin 3-star restaurants, only 6 have female chefs certainly tells me otherwise. Or do men only know how to cook the fancy, prestigious meals that come with press coverage? C. Do there really need to be etiquette articles about this whole mess? How not only is the straight-up donation of one's time, money, and effort not good enough, but you should also really try to switch up the meal choices. Do something not only unexpected, but also excellent, and something everyone from 2 years old to their great-grandparents will like. Guaranteed. Don't drop off dishes that need to be returned. Bring enough food for everyone, but not too much, or there won't be any room left in the refrigerator. Oh, and maybe bring flowers or a gift for the oldest kid, and definitely some ice cream. And what the fuck is this shit? Do you want help or not? Maybe we could all chip in and buy you a restaurant and a farmer's market instead? Maybe for your birthday you could tell me everything you don't like in advance and then afterward tell me everything that was wrong with the gift I gave you? D. Stop assuming all women cook or have the time to cook. Oh my God. E. I told you I was horrible. Answer key. All. Especially E's. Unsubscribe. Your participation trophies are bullshit. It was the end of horseback riding camp, and my daughter clip-clopped over to me in her dirt and manure-encrusted boots. She held up her two ribbons, one red and one blue. She singled out the blue one and said, "You don't like this one, do you?" "Of course I don't. You got that one just for breathing." She knows how I feel about awards or ribbons or trophies or certificates or shout-outs just for the sake of recognizing a child as among the living, and has managed to drag his or her carcass to camp, to a game or practice, to the play, to class, through life. I don't know where this whole thing started, but I don't like it. I thought this was something that sprung up in the 90s, and we all made fun of now. I actually thought we were over it, especially in this age of resilience and grit and other super important parenting buzzwords. But then my kid signed up for the elementary school play, and I had to attend the mandatory parent meeting. If there's one thing I can't get enough of, it's mandatory parent meetings, especially the kind that happen at night, right around dinner time. Oh, baby. I sat there leafing through multiple handouts, a complicated calendar, and rules containing several points of emphasis in underline, bold, and all caps. My kids were only in fourth and fifth grade, not on Broadway. Couldn't they just throw on an old cat costume and call it a day? Maybe one of them could be a son. I don't know. As the women leading the meeting made clear, every kid who wanted to be in the play would be in the play. Every kid would have a role. We're talking more than 100 kids. Every kid in fourth and fifth grade would get speaking lines guaranteed. They had counted all the lines in the script and divided them by grade and number of kids. The higher grades getting more lines and singing solos, and the lower grades getting the smaller parts. But no one should emphasize big versus little speaking roles. All roles were important. There are no big parts. But there are big parts. I took it all in, thinking back on my own experiences of participating in plays in school. I had to take both hands and push my jaw back up into place. I looked around the room so I could lock eyes with other like-minded parents. We'd definitely give each other that look that said, "What the hell is this?" There was no way I could be the only one bewildered by the fact there'd be three Simbas and three Nalas. Why was every supporting character in The Lion King exploded into a gang of multiples with rhyming names? What was even happening here? I looked around the room, scanning faces for that look of recognition, and I saw nothing. Absolutely nothing. Not a face turned toward mine, not a single parent who looked surprised or upset by this information. In fact, several had their notebooks out or their phones open to a notes app as they jotted down the dictated information. Some asked follow-up questions like, "When you say small role, how many lines would that be?" Or, "Number of lines-wise, what is the difference between a small and medium speaking part?" What are you even saying? My Chipotle order is ready. Let's wrap this fucking cuckoo fest up. When I returned home, I dumped my color-coded printouts, the calendar, the permission slips, and all the rules out onto the kitchen counter. This is absurd. Do you realize you have a speaking part no matter what? Yes, my daughter answered brightly. No, I went on. That's just so wrong. So wrong. That's not how plays work in the real world. That's not how anything works in the real world. You're supposed to try out for a play. The kids who are the best actors or actresses and singers get the best and biggest parts. Oh, I forgot. There are no big parts, I added sarcastically. She just shrugged. For some reason, kids don't love monologues. I know this participation trophy approach didn't start with this particular theater company, and it didn't start with the owners of the horse farm where my daughter attended camp. Schools and organizations, anyone dealing with kids, have been trained by almost three decades of parents to recognize children blindly and equally, no matter how much they suck. We do our children a disservice when we support this narrative, when we tell them they're great at everything, excellent at whatever they attempt, good job. Kids are smart. They look to us for truth. When we tell them something that doesn't totally jibe with their perception and experience, what does that say about us? That, at the minimum, we're kind of liars? I'm not suggesting we come at them boot camp style and scream about everything they're terrible at. What I am suggesting is we take steps to free our teachers, schools, camp leaders, coaches, instructors, other parents, and culture, pretty easy, right? From enforcing this fairy tale that every kid is exceptional and perfect. Because it is not true. You know it. I know it. Everyone knows it. Kids definitely know it. They can pick out which kid is the killer soccer player, an incredible artist, a big-time reader. Saying, "So are you," isn't just wrong. It belittles true achievement. Sure, everyone should be able to take a crack at something they've never tried before. This is what ultimately made me back off my school play flip-out. I had to recognize I was comparing elementary school with high school. Clearly not a fair comparison. Every kid in elementary school should get a chance to be in a play. Does it have to be a play where a production truck is parked outside the gym during tech rehearsal week? Debatable. I'm not sure I even heard the phrase tech rehearsal before my junior year of high school. But every kid certainly deserves a shot to create, to compete, and to push themselves in whatever way they choose. They should also be able to trust that when they win something, they have won it fair and square, through studying hard, loads of discipline, or lots of practice. They should be able to own it deep in their bones. They should know it's real. Yet even when kids know the truth, they can, of course, become groomed over time to expect our empty praises. Who doesn't like to hear good things about themselves? I know I do. We also fell into the good job trap when our kids were little. Recently, as my daughter and I cleaned out her room and sorted through stacks upon stacks of old drawings, making piles for recycling, for her to keep, for me to keep, she was offended when I would send anything to the recycling graveyard. Sure, part of that is she knows I'm nostalgic and would save everything if I could. But another part of this whole mess is she's still used to being praised for whatever she does, for making so much as a crooked line across a piece of paper. Because we have done it, other parents have done it, her teachers have done it, our culture has done it. We are good-jobbing kids right into incompetency. When she first tried horseback riding, something that is a hobby of the rich for a reason, as we have painfully discovered, we were fortunate to find a tough teacher. She's around my age and doesn't have children. I think that part is important. And she doesn't teach a ton of kids. It's not a kid-centric farm, another key factor. She is a horse person. She takes horses seriously. She takes the care of them seriously. And she knows firsthand if you fuck around when it comes to horses, you can find yourself in a world of hurt. My daughter was finishing up her very first attempt at tacking up her horse. And Mary, her instructor, commented, "Okay, so you say you're done. Can you tell me that is absolutely the best job you can do? That animal is depending on you to do your best." D-A-M-N. I was standing behind Mary, and my daughter and I exchanged a look like we had both been punched in the face. But that punch felt good to me. I realized as much as I thought I was trying to back away from overly praising her every breath and move, I needed to relearn what real talk was. It wasn't about breaking anyone down or being needlessly cruel. It was about introducing the concept that there are standards, that life is a process of rising up to meet those standards, that hard work is essential to building confidence and feeling capable. And most important, there is always more to learn. We can always get better at whatever it is we do. My daughter has slipped up only a few times since then. She has learned to be meticulous with her horse. Because she has been introduced to those expectations. And Mary isn't going to get in there and help her do it. She doesn't care that my daughter's 11 and her mom is standing right there. Not her problem. She trusts that my daughter can do it. And after feeling a bit adrift without all that supervision and hand-holding, my daughter could do it herself. She had been pushed beyond her comfort zone and rose to the challenge. Maybe it wasn't the most difficult challenge in the world. But it was one more step in what should be a lifelong journey of building competency. And while kids deserve to experience true competition as well as discover what they are uniquely good at, it's just as valuable for them to know where and when to cut bait. In my own experience, learning what I suck at has been just as important as identifying my strengths. It tells me what I should no longer put energy toward or beat myself up over. And it allows me to channel my focus, talent, and attention on the things that matter. It's insane to imagine an adult being equally good at acting, singing, football, playing the piano, drawing, baseball, horseback riding, coding, writing jokes, and archery. Yet this is what we're telling kids every day. You are good, no, great, at everything. Your work here is done. There is nothing quite like that edgy and exciting feeling of trying out for something, competing, waiting to see if your name is on the list. The callback, the team, the cast. I have stood on tippy-toes on the outskirts of a huddle of teenagers scanning for my name. I have been elated. I have been crushed. Each experience taught me that the things you want don't always come easy, and sometimes they don't come at all. Sometimes it showed me that the things I thought I wanted, I actually didn't. I wanted them because my friends wanted them or someone else wanted them for me, but I just didn't have it in me. Or maybe I wanted to be good at this one particular thing, but I wasn't, plain and simple. Instead of beating my head against the twin brick walls of fate and genetics, better to plow my drive and smarts into something I could actually improve in. When we deny our kids that sort of process, to figure out their natural gifts, their potential gifts, to let go of the stuff they're just not good at so they can invest more in the areas where they show true passion and promise, we are denying them the process of growing up, of being prepared for the world they will be living in, a world where they will get their asses handed to them on a regular basis. Nowhere is this clash across generations and the mismatching of expectations more glaringly apparent than in the workplace. And sure, this whole, you damn kids don't know the meaning of hard work, and you also don't know how to deal with criticism, like, at all, complaint isn't new. But watch me launch into it anyway. I've stood speechless as interns scoffed at the tasks they'd been given, as I simultaneously recalled all the months I spent standing in front of a copier with my pumps off when I was an intern. All of us of a certain age, collectively willing the cycle of professional hazing to continue, can barely contain ourselves from screaming, "You're an intern, jackass!" Or junior designers who would expect to be made senior designers after surviving in their jobs for 12 whole months, all by themselves. They weren't born with those expectations. Those expectations were nurtured. They went through elementary school, middle school, high school, and college being told they were excellent, talented, and without a single flaw. That they deserved things, promotions, raises, accolades, simply for showing up. What's wrong with kids these days? Looks a lot like how we're raising kids right now. With the golden light of perfection always shining down upon them. We don't want them to be sad or frustrated, because that makes us feel bad. It makes us feel like terrible parents. But if that's how we're going to do things, then we should at least own the fact that when we hand out trophies and ribbons and certificates merely for existing, what we are actually saying is this. You have won now, but you will lose so much more later. September 17th, 2010. The day I turned the car around. There are only a handful of things I'll never forget. Most I'll never remember. Of course, I didn't know that at the time. In those first few years of growing and feeding and burping and bouncing and cursing and loving my kids, I was saturated with experiences, bowled over by firsts, and laid low by exhaustion and frustration. Call it what you will, the happiest time of your life, really. The early days, new motherhood. But no matter what you call it, there's no denying it's vivid. I trusted my brain to file away every favorite food and word, all the mannerisms and comedy routines, funny walks and mind-bending questions. Even though I was submerged in serious stress and suffering from a profound lack of sleep, I still felt confident the sheer novelty of these moments were enough to leave indelible marks, like bronzed fingerprints, all over my brain. I figured there was no way I could forget even a single second of it. I remember almost none of it. I probably forgot most of it almost as quickly as it happened. Details were swapped out for newer details, mannerisms swapped out for the latest models, foods and jokes and questions all updated with the latest version. It was as if a dialogue box kept popping up in my head that read, "An item that's similar already exists in this location. Do you want to replace it with the one that's happening right now?" And I clicked yes, over and over again. But there is one day that stands out. Oh, ho boy, does it. We were setting off for a day trip to a children's science museum, a solid 1 hour and 45-minute drive from our house. I remember the exact drive time because it became a regular destination once my kids were old enough, and I was capable enough to make it worthwhile. It had everything going for it. Exhibits awaited kid fingers and eyes and ears. There were gears to be cranked and buttons to be pushed, sounds to hear and sights to see. No need to have excuses at the ready for strangers. No 4.5-minute preparatory speech in the car before they were released. This was a place for them and their people. There is a certain sort of disgusting relief in that. Those are the days you know you're an American mom. Those are the days you feel unnatural gratitude for whoever invented stickers and then came up with systems to use them. Those are the days you have nothing to lose. In the summer, the museum expanded to include an outdoor science park with water exhibits. I can still picture my two little sidekicks on one of our earliest trips, in swim diapers and swimsuits, chubby thighs and exploding delight as the fountains popped up and disappeared. Back inside, they made giant bubbles and totally touched the stuffed moose surrounded by "do not touch" signs and reasonable explanations of why not. Oils from your hands, old fur, something, something, I really don't remember. There were penny games, miniature tornadoes, and contained fog, and an indoor play area with tunnels and a tower for the youngest kids. That place was perfect. No matter what, by the time we left, they'd be tuckered out and happy. And I'd have the satisfaction of feeling like we had done something educational, even if all they got out of it was the incontrovertible fact that leaf-cutting ants are a one-way ticket to Heebie-Jeebieville. After one last trip to the bathroom, they'd be in clean, dry clothes, with full bellies from a late lunch, imaginations tweaked, and tired legs from exploring. I'd buckle them back into the car, feeling happy we had had a full day out in the world. It's still surprising to me how gratifying it can be to simply check off those basics, to feel like I've provided them with simple comforts and a little joy. But before I get too misty-eyed about it, the other thing that was gratifying about that trip was, without fail, they'd both completely crash out either on the way there or back. So, to sum up, guaranteed quiet time, ability to listen to NPR like the good, liberal bubble dweller that I am, boundless opportunity to drink my coffee in orgasmic peace while also escaping the natural disaster that was our house? Obviously, add me to your mailing list, science nerds. Of course I'll join your museum. Take all my money. I'm not going to be modest about this. September 17th, 2010, still stands as the single best day in my parenting history. Our morning started out as so many others had. A loose plan, a patriotic amount of snacks packed, coffee in hand, and fully ready to feel the glory of the open road. Let's get the hell out of this house and into the world, kids. We've got people to irritate. And like so many other mornings, there was a whole lot of repeating of instructions and not listening and it taking us as much time to get out the door as it would have to drive all the way there already. They were fighting and foot dragging and working my last nerve, but I didn't see those as signs of things to come. I just saw those as signs that we were all awake. We broke the surly bonds of our driveway and then our street, our neighborhood, then that other neighborhood, and a few more, finally gliding onto the interstate. Nothing but super sexy highway as far as the eye could see. Initiate driving sequence. Coffee being ingested? Check. NPR on? Check. Kids quietly relaxing in the back seat, not at all sticking their fingers into each other's armpits, tummies, eyes, and or ears? Negative. Houston, we have a cliche. This was not the blast-off I was hoping for. That day was overcast after a storm and puddles of sloshy, muddy water dotted sidewalks and roads. My kids were still relatively little, 4 and 6, but certainly the proverbial old enough to know better on so many levels. They more or less understood rules. They pretty much knew what would get them into trouble. They mostly listened to me, and I thought they understood what would send curtains of hellfire raining down upon their heads. But clearly, I was mistaken. It hadn't even been a half hour before it became clear it was still bullshit o'clock in my car in a big way. They didn't listen. When I asked them to stop, they did the straight-up opposite of the words that were coming out of my face. Their expressions told me over and over again, Oh, we heard you. We just really don't seem to care about what you're saying at this particular moment. Undaunted, and having already invested entirely too much time and effort in our jailhouse break, there was no way in hell we were turning back now. Or were we? Why were these children who I loved so very much trying to rob me of my simple joys? This was my chill time, my you guys shut up and I listen to NPR time, and they were totally ruining it. It also became clear that I went to the bathroom before we left was the biggest lie that had ever been lied, and we were already pulling off at a rest area. Much unbuckling and holding of hands ensued. The whole performative dance that is little kids and a mom in a rest area bathroom commenced. My son was terrified of loud sounds and hadn't yet mastered the one-arm wraparound cover-both-ears move that would become his signature later. So he shuffled in with hands mashed over his head, wary of the hand dryers that were going off as all the callous adult hand washers went about their business, blasting those things left and right. He had no hands free to actually undo his pants and pull down his underpants. So that was definitely one of my favorite arguments we always got in, the one about needing your hands. No, I'm not moving my hands. You need your hands. No, it's too loud. But hands. And on until I keel over dead. Whenever we would actually survive the hand dryer assault, it'd be on to the horror of spontaneously flushing toilets that would send both kids over the edge. In all fairness, if there's one thing that should be predictable in its behavior, it's a toilet. Nobody needs to be naked from hips to knees and shift their weight ever so slightly, only to be greeted with a random spritz of toilet water up the old caboose while simultaneously feeling like maybe you'll be sucked down into the center of the earth. Mercifully fleeing the Tasmanian vortex in the bathroom stall, it'd be off to the sink to wash hands, which, again, is hard to do when you don't use your actual hands because they're slammed against your ears as prep for the hand dryer rematch. Oh my God! After what easily felt like 5 days, we were finally free of the bathrooms. I beelined for the car, wiping my dripping wet hands on my jeans and thinking, did I ever really used to enter, use, and exit the bathroom in under a week in my previous life? I feel like I did. I mean, I must have. As my brain was caught up in trying to solve this life puzzle, I whipped around to make sure my kids were actually still following me. That's when I saw them. Just as they spied the muddy puddles. They heard me say, "Don't jump in those muddy puddles," and, "Seriously, do not. You don't have any clean." And there they went, jumping and giggling with that glint in their eyes that said, "LOL parenting." Typically, in this sort of situation, I would resort to the time-honored parenting method commonly referred to as losing one's shit, which is largely associated with actions that include, but are not limited to, yelling and counting slowly and loudly up to three. But I had recently discovered when things got especially dark, it was more effective if I took a different tack. With what I imagined to be the sort of approach the mafia might employ, I pulled both kids close to me, put my lips right to their ears, and in a voice so disturbingly quiet they could barely hear me, I hissed, "Get in the car. Now." Why this works, I have no idea. It still works. To be fair, I think if someone came up to me, clasped my head, and whispered something mildly threatening, I would definitely do whatever they said. Even let them take me to the second location. Whatever. I would just want the arm or head clasping and the intimate weird whispering to end. As I ushered them along through the sheer force of my cumulative anger, I announced, "This is your last warning. If you guys don't listen and keep getting in trouble, we're going home. Do you hear me?" How many times have we all said something like that? I'd also accept other variations on this theme, like, "Do you want to leave now? Should we go home now? That's it, we're going home now. This is your final warning. I'm not saying it one more time. This is the last time I say it. Did you hear me say this is the last time I'm going to say it? Okay, I'll say it one more time. This is it. And I mean it this time." There's really nothing like saying, "That's the last time I'm going to say it," to boldly underline how much it really is not the last time you're going to say it. What we're all basically saying over and over again is, "I do not want to go through the physical effort, never mind the behavioral shitstorm, that will be unleashed if I try to put this whole thing in motion." And as we all know, it's even more meaningless when we're threatening to leave a thing or place where we as parents actually want to stay. The beach, a movie, a party, anywhere that's not our own house. That's when the threats are as hollow as my soul. Eventually, we all returned to the car, me fuming and feeling the weight of this final warning now hanging over me, them only the slightest bit delayed, as if they had hit a speed bump going 27 instead of the suggested 25. I eased the car back onto the highway, turned the radio up, and hoped that was the end of it. After what was maybe a 15-minute reprieve tops, during which I imagine they had unfurled an old-timey map across their laps to hash out their battle plan like little World War II generals, they started fighting again, and harassing each other, and screaming and yelling, which caused me to scream and yell back and tell them to knock it off because they had already had one warning. Didn't they remember that? It was the last one before the one I just said. And that's when it happened. Of course, like so many other things, the details of what exactly that last straw was remain lost to history. It might have been a smack or a slap or a poke or a scream or them calling each other a butt. Who knows? All I know is that it was enough for me to see an exit coming up, put on my turn signal, and in a remarkably calm voice say, "That's it. Lightning. I warned you guys. Thunder." My car took the exit. "The storm is closer than you think." Both kids immediately erupted in screams as my car took the off-ramp, hooked a left, continued across the overpass, and then got back on the highway, in the opposite direction. "No, Mom, no, no, no!" I had never heard them simultaneously scream and beg so loudly in my entire life. My ears were ringing. If the windows had been down, anyone passing us couldn't be blamed if they thought a crime was being committed in my vehicle. Neither my husband nor I had ever pulled off such a day-obliterating move before. They didn't know whether to cry or shriek or beg or completely flip out. So they did all those things at the same time. Both kids did all those things at the same time. They were hysterical. They could not be contained. They were thrashing around, begging for mercy. They were crying so hard they couldn't even breathe. One of them started coughing and choking. They kept triggering each other exponentially with their freakouts, because as much as one kid was freaking out, seeing their sibling freak out at this never-before-seen freakout level was sending both of them spiraling into the freakout stratosphere. They begged for one more chance. "Please, please, please, Mom!" They promised to be good for the rest of the drive, for the whole day, for the rest of their lives. "Nope. Too late. We're going home." "Ah!" Another wave of pure psychological breakdown engulfed the car. They had just learned the world was a real fuck show of a place, and other people can destroy your damn lives. Just like that. Even people who you had previously trusted and thought you loved. And those people could do it without flinching, without feeling sorry about it, all while sipping their coffee. I turned the radio up. I felt so calm. One might even say peaceful. I had a slight grin that wouldn't have been out of place on the face of a serial killer. The screaming and begging continued. I turned the radio up a little louder. It's really hard to hear the latest in national and local news, not to mention the 17-minute-long weather report, with all that screaming and carrying on. After what felt like infinity minutes of this rolling horror show, I pulled off the highway to send my husband a text. The kids took this as a sign that I might turn the car back around. An eerie silence settled over us. They realized I was capable of anything now. I typed, "We were 1 hour and 15 minutes into our drive to Montshire. We were less than a half hour away. The kids were acting like dicks. I just turned the car around. It feels good. It feels timeless. Send." My kids are now 11 and 13. To this day, that's the only time I ever turned the car around. It was the only time I've had to. That one spontaneous decision blossomed into a long-term investment. I never had to tell them I'd pull some serious shit if they were misbehaving, because they had already seen me do it up close. All I had to say was, "Do you really want to try me?" And turns out they didn't. They knew. Of course, they were little then, and we're hardly into the wilds of the teenage years now, a time when I won't expect more than a shrug, even if I dynamited our entire house. But it was a good run. So do it. Turn the car around. Leave the party. Blow up the movie plans. Kill the beach trip. Carry them out over your shoulder, kicking and screaming, and yes, in public. You're the one in charge. It feels good to remember that part. Just one suggestion from a veteran of September 17th. Only throw that threat down for something you really don't care about missing. Because who are you really trying to punish anyway? The Ghosts of Halloween's Past. I walked past a towering barn and through the late autumn woods. Stubborn yellow leaves, the only ones left hanging on to stark, alarmed branches. Sunflower stalks arched into canes, their heads bowed in grief. The smell of the forest in the fall is unmistakable, all of that decaying, earthy sweetness underfoot. I feel wrapped in comfort and loss, time slipping away. The wind choosing to lie very still, holding its breath, or blow up in a huff, causing me to feel panic down to my toes. Shuffling through the leaves and somber air sent me back to the fall days I took for granted when I was growing up in my small hometown in Massachusetts. Taking things for granted was my specialty back then, when I was a kid and then a teenager. If I were to pause long enough, I'd realize it still is. Halloween isn't until this weekend, and as is customary now, my kids have already celebrated it twice. I had to think back to what costumes I used to wear when Halloween came just once. I don't remember my parents being involved at all, although they must have been. For at least two Halloweens, I dressed up like a hobo, the go-to costume for the unprepared. Although with my flannel shirt, bandana tied to a stick, rosy red cheeks, and straw hat, I looked more like a cross between a scarecrow and a rodeo clown. My friend Linda and I made a plan, put on our costumes, and went trick-or-treating. Alone. Parents didn't tag along then, and they certainly didn't make it an occasion for walking around the neighborhood with cocktails. Now, after more than 10 years of parenting while under the influence of Halloween, it's had its effect. There are always costumes to get, details to nail down, trick-or-treating to arrange, maybe a class party to contribute to. I skate on the very edge of helpfulness, generally speaking. And yet, it still happens. I still end up in the mix. I want my kids to have fun, and I want to take pictures. I'm convinced "I wanted my kids to have fun" will be etched on the vast majority of modern mothers' tombstones. And "she wanted to take pictures" is what kids will request on theirs. But Halloween is beginning to feel smaller. Although my son plans on wearing the same police officer costume he's worn for the past 4 years, he hesitated when we attended a Halloween parade over the weekend. Never mind that he's worn it year-round to ride his bike or give visitors a tour of our house. Suddenly, at an actual Halloween-themed event, he balked. "I feel like a jerk," was the first thing he said when we arrived, even though kids his age as well as teenagers and adults were also in costume. This is the year he's noticing differences, and other kids are noticing what's different about him. And although I know he's not the only one going through this, he does not. My daughter decided to go as an artist this year, and she gave me a very specific list of the wardrobe items she hoped for. I kept badgering her to add a beret and make a painter's palette, so, you know, people would know what she actually was. She stuck to her list. By some sort of thrifting miracle, I found every single item during a 20-minute sweep of Goodwill. I even found a black beret and bought it, knowing she'd probably refuse it. And she did. And I was done with Halloween prep, just like that. When they were younger, I would question them throughout September about what they wanted to be. Once I managed to get 3 consistent answers in a row, I'd start scouring eBay and Etsy for costumes. A unicorn, a puppy, a skunk, and a black cat have all arrived in the mail. 1/3 of the costumes handmade by someone else, the sweetest of scores. Improbably, 1 year I tracked down a bluebird costume. "Are you sure you don't want to be a peacock? Those are easier for me to find." Someone had made it by stitching a blue feather boa all over a blue Old Navy sweatshirt in a size just big enough for my daughter. In the package were the matching yellow feet that could be threaded through her shoelaces, and a beak to go over her nose. As they've gotten older, I've slowly come to realize that Halloween, like first days of school and believing in Santa, doesn't actually go on forever. That every exasperated, "Ugh, I can't wait for Halloween to be over," as I scrambled to the store to get face paint or nail polish or tights, is now being met with the realization that someday it will be over. For good. Relief. Then regret. I would have trick-or-treated until I left for college if my parents had let me, but my dad took me off the candy shakedown circuit when I was 13. And just like that, instead of raking in free Snickers at the whopping 9 houses on our dead-end street, I ended up in a soccer field in the dark with my girlfriends and boys who were 2 or 3 years older than us. We had eggs cracked on our heads and maple syrup poured on our Letterman jackets. We slid down hills near the soccer field in the dark and ran around screaming. It felt, in that any attention is good attention way, like a baptism. I wasn't a kid anymore. I was a teenager, a troublemaker. Someone who would walk into her small-town grocery store, smeared with what was essentially half a recipe, and walk nonchalantly to the refrigerated section to grab as many cartons of eggs as I had cash. It was the kind of night where you stand with your best friend in line, knowing your life is changing but not sure exactly how, and say too loudly to each other as you pay for all those eggs, "Oh man, can't wait to bake a really big cake when we get home," as if those cashiers had the intelligence of a pile of rocks with eyes. As if they had never been young. The long, arching branches that bow over the paths I've walked, the crisp leaves I've kicked through, and the dirt roads I've driven down since returning to New England all call me back to other high school parties held among the hay bales and in distant fields. Nights when we hung upside down from branches in a graveyard, smoking cigarettes and screaming just to hear our own voices. Couples kissing next to tombstones, lying on long-ago repacked dirt, their outstretched bodies just feet above skeletons, the taste of peppermint schnapps on their lips. I can still feel the sharp October air of those nights, and see the face of the full moon watching us live among the dead. But times change. Towns barely allow actual trick-or-treating anymore, never mind egg massacres and graveyard parties. Some things never change, though, like outgrowing who you were before. It happens when you're 9 and 11, and as it turns out, 47. You feel different, and you know things are different, but you're not sure how. Like a toddler straight out of an attachment parenting book, you rush ahead but keep checking back in. My kids check back in with me now as intensely as they want to take off without me. I stumble out into whatever this next phase of my life is, and I check back in with them too. Are we still us? I know the real Halloweens, the ones made for kid costumes and candy trading, aren't over. Not really. Not yet. But it's like seeing the leaves change on that first tree in August, the one that just can't hold its horses. My kids are racing into life, a life that one day will go on without me. As Halloween approached, I told my daughter in a last-ditch effort, "But if people see the beret, they'll know you're an artist." She shook her head and said, "I'll know I'm an artist." And having known a lot of artists, I can verify not one of them has ever worn a beret, but a lot of them have worn knee-high boots, a shirt splattered with paint, or bright colors in their hair, just like she planned on wearing. Every day they're trying on who they want to be. I see them gauging reactions, measuring laughs, reluctantly accepting hugs and kisses on cheeks. They grow their hair long. She asks to get her ears pierced or wear makeup. He flashes a peace sign at his friends on the bus as it rolls away. They feel the shift of their own strange baptisms already, and the pull of attention. I've reached back, through the smell of wood smoke and the opening of milkweed, to realize I was once a child in autumn too. I have roamed neighborhoods and forests and graveyards, feeling invincible, immortal. I have hesitated and balked, then run full force into the unknown. It's their time now, to try on and try out, to forge their own paths through these shifting seasons. The rituals we created together will inevitably wane. They will have to. It is the wide open field, begging for exploration, and the cold blue sky pointing the way toward migration. It is the flat, still air and the sudden huffing and puffing of change. Time out. Radiohead song or accurate description of my parenting. 1. Scatterbrain. 2. Arbitrary justice. 3. I might be wrong. 4. Slammed doors. 5. 2 plus 2 equals 5. 6. Go to sleep. 7. I can't. 8. Head in hands. 9. Down is the new up. 10. Existential implosion. 11. Sulk. 12. Stop whispering. 13. Dirty laundry infinity. 14. Shouting out of proportion. 15. Let down. 16. I told you 1,000 times. 17. You and whose army? 18. Man down. 19. Slips of permission. 20. Fog. 21. Life in a glass house. 22. Who's the adult? 23. Worrywart. 24. You never wash up after yourself. 25. Red wine massacre. 26. 4-minute warning. 27. Crying in public. 28. These are my twisted words. 29. A reminder. 30. I never said I knew what I was doing. 31. House of cards. 32. At a loss. 33. I am citizen insane. 34. Accidental successes. 35. Permanent daylight. 36. What? Radiohead song. 1, 6, 7, 9, 11, 12, 17, 20, 21, 24, 26, 28, 29, 31, 35. Accurate description of my parenting. 2, 4, 8, 10, 13, 14, 16, 18, 19, 22, 25, 27, 30, 32, 34, 36. Both. 3, 5, 15, 23, 33. Are you sure there isn't something else I can do before the end of the school year? Are you sure I can't fill out and or sign another field trip form, fundraising form, class placement form, book order form, class party form, popsicle request, overdue library books notice, missing library books notice, school district feedback form, 1 month of half-filled out reading logs? Are you sure I can't contribute to one last bake sale or five? Are you sure I can't make it something gluten-free, nut-free, egg-free, dairy-free, non-GMO, organic, and or won't hurt anyone's feelings? Are you sure bright pink fake fat frosting from a can won't work? Have I mentioned I have the culinary skills of a potato? Are you sure I can't send in money for a yearbook? A class trip to get ice cream sandwiches? A PTO donation? A visiting author's signed book? Tickets for the end of school year party? A baseball game? The stupid recorders I didn't even want my kids to have in the first place? Are you sure I can't get the money to you in the form of a check because I'm a pioneer woman? Are you positive you don't want to accept PayPal or Square or... No, I know, that's crazy. You're not a spaceship. Are you sure I can't chaperone one or all 11 of the field trips between now and the last day of school? Don't worry, I no longer have time to hold down a job. By the way, remember all that time between January and April? What happened there? Are you sure there isn't some sort of spring concert, adorable play, other emotionally manipulative school event to go to now or every night until the last day of school? You know, something where maybe one of the boys can wear a too big tie or the tallest girl in class can shyly stoop down in the back row? Maybe it could be a third grade dance or a fifth grade graduation? That sort of thing. Are you sure 273 art projects couldn't be sent home all at once? Preferably stuffed into a flimsy, about-to-split-open plastic grocery bag? Are you sure you aren't giving me some other kid's stuff, too? Are you sure there can't be some sort of complicated theme weeks my kids can get all whipped up over, even though they could barely manage to pair a shirt with pants the other 41 weeks of the year? If possible, could it be something where we'll have to gather an incredibly random assortment of props on extremely short notice? Maybe an orange wig, two different colors of the same style of shoes, and a sports jersey from 1991? Just spitballing here. Can you make sure any errands related to each theme can be spread out among multiple locations across town, thereby obliterating one entire day from the scoreboard of my life? Are you sure a room parent can't come up with one or three end-of-year classroom projects like that one time when we had 2 days' notice for each kid to cut out 38 2-inch by 2-inch squares for a paper mosaic project? And I mean 2 inches by 2 inches exactly. It said so in the email. Something complicated and requiring extreme precision is exactly the sort of thing I'm in the mood for right now. Got anything like that? Are you sure I can't get you a teacher gift? Are you sure I can't read some shitty mom blog posts about what an appropriate teacher gift might be? Are you sure I can't just get you a nice bottle of wine? I have one right here. It's already open. Are you sure you need to give me that summer reading list, library flyer, academic camp brochure? Are you sure I can't just let my kids get dumber by 1/3 until they come back here in the fall like we all used to? Are you sure you can't make me panic more about how little time I have until the school year is almost over? So I can be reminded the only thing that allows me to approach my work with any sort of mental and structural stability, not to mention without going bankrupt, is about to go away for 10 weeks? I'm not panicking enough about that. Can you help me? Schools. The walls that define us. I showed up to my son's kindergarten tour same day hungover. Because, as it turned out, it was also the day I lost my job of 6 years. The job we had moved across the country for. I never saw it coming. Mostly what I remember about that night, aside from the deep existential panic, throbbing headache, and the fact I was grateful I didn't know anyone because maybe my face was always this splotchy and my eyes always this bloodshot, was seeing all the artwork on the walls as we walked around. I wasn't sure when I had last been inside an elementary school, but it was an amount of time measured in decades. The art-filled bulletin board swooped me back to my favorite elementary school teacher, Miss Slozak, who indulged my obsession with Snoopy by letting me draw him over and over again for her classroom walls. I reflexively smiled at the self-portraits bursting with chiclet teeth and spider-lashed eyes, yarn hair, and names carefully written out in blocky letters. I eventually fell behind our small tour group, staring at a papier-mâché solar system through increasingly tear-blurred eyes and wondered, will my son even go here? Will we have to move? Have I let everyone down? But we stayed. I started freelancing 2 days later, and he went to that school, Vermont's first arts magnet elementary school, and so did his sister. What had been a failing school in a poor neighborhood was entering a transition period of becoming something different, something greater. And, I hoped, so were we. What struck me every morning I walked through those doors and every afternoon as I lingered, waiting for the bell to ring, were those walls. A construction paper pumpkin patch with a Van Gogh sky, family portraits and abstract trees, windows covered with tissue paper, stained glass, and a hallway populated with craft paper penguin families made to scale. And while it was an arts-focused school, every elementary school was supposed to feel like this. Learning and creativity made visible, a safe place to wear your heart on the outside. But it seems life is never that simple, not always what the brochure promises. My son had a slow-motion train wreck of a kindergarten year, where I heard about his horrible day almost every day, how he crawled under tables crying, clapped his hands over his ears, and shook, his behaviors new and awful. His school not knowing how to parse a bright boy with unpredictable freakouts. In one memorable meeting, I watched politics play out between the principal, teachers, and the special ed staff, while my temper slowly rose like a cartoon thermometer. My son discussed as a problem that didn't fit neatly into their process. I sat there bewildered and on the edge of tears, finally hissing, "Why won't you help him?" If a public elementary school wouldn't help my kid, I reasoned, who would? Aren't these the schools for everyone? For every child? No matter what? For every valley there was a peak. A new principal was eventually hired, and most important, stayed. This school we took a chance on took chances on us over and over again, even as we left for a year to homeschool and worked hard to get him to a place where he could re-enroll. He found his champions every single year, and with a depth of gratitude I'll feel for the rest of my life, they found him too. My daughter found her own favorite teacher, one who indulged her with an entire day in her